and I tried to attack a drug dealer. My friend had to carry me out because this guy was going to stab me. Even for myself, it took me a long time to identify that I was an addict because I had those own stereotypes in my head of what an addict really looked like.
The stereotype, because it's like Chris Rock with a bag of cocaine outside someone's car, and it's like, no, this is a working person. Sorry, but that's what I see, you know. So you're going to work, you're showing up.
Yep.
Can anybody else in your life tell that you are building towards an addiction?
I think that's really important to say about any kind of substance abuse or addiction is that it is incredibly sneaky. It doesn't just turn up on your doorstep and then is suddenly there. It really creeps up on you. I was gonna die. I was killing myself, willingly killing myself. And I was asking God to fix it, but he wasn't going to just take it away.
Yeah.
I had to actually hand it over.
Welcome to the Magnify Conversations. I'm Rachel and I'm one of the hosts today. If you're new, welcome. We hope that this content will be really helpful and beneficial to you. If you're a regular, it's great to have you back. And one way you can help us to get this out and to benefit more women is by subscribing to this channel. We would love you to do that. And today it's my privilege to introduce Sinead, who will be my co-host.
Hi, I'm Sinead Mink. I'm so excited to be co-hosting with Rachel on The Conversations, and we're looking to have open discussions about faith, life, work, career, and relationships, and how our faith really works in the midst of all of those things. So I'm so excited to be a part of this today.
Yeah, let's get into this conversation.
So we're so excited to have you, Jo, on today's episode. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jo. I've lived in London since I was 18. I grew up in Cambridge. I'm a freelance creative consultant, so I work in advertising, and yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, we'll hear more today as well, won't we? We're going to start with a little icebreaker. Is that okay? Oh, we can all join in, though. Right. So we're going to do, do you know Desert Island Discs?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to mix it up a little bit, right? Okay. So the three questions are this. First one, if you're on a desert island, you have to say who you'd take and why.
Yeah.
What's the, what? I mean, there's no Netflix on a desert island, but what's the Netflix show you would watch and why? And then lastly, what's the one luxury you would take and why?
Oh my goodness, that's quite hard. Okay, I would take my mum.
Oh,
I know. Oh,
that was really sweet.
She'd drive me mad, but I love her. Aww. And we would find a way to make it really fun.
Yeah.
And she's very practical.
Right.
So she'd be really good.
You're with safe, safe pair of hands.
She'd be able to build a hut. And forage for food. I'd be fed and watered, so that would be good.
From a survival point of view, it's working.
Exactly. So both kind of being able to enjoy myself and also not die would be great. Netflix episodes or series. Ooh, that one's really tough. Because this is a real insight into what I watch. I watch a lot of true crime
documentaries. Oh, gosh. Okay, yeah, me too. True crime people. Why do you watch? I don't even watch.
It's really interesting.
The ad alone is enough. Like, I can't even deal. Like, I'm a stalker and it's like, oh my gosh, please. Like, no, I can't. Yeah.
Let's just say I would take
it
a true.
It would be from that genre.
It would, yes, it would be a true crime documentary. I'm sorry. What would yours be then?
Oof, I'm just because I'm watching something now I need to finish called Fool Me Once. So it just came out.
Yeah,
so I'm
just,
it's actually really bad, but I have to know how it ends. So that's what
Do you
I
recommend
just know.
It then?
No. I mean, some people love it, but I just already know like this is too many twists and turns. Yeah.
Right.
I think I just like consistent, steady, Pride and Prejudice, boring, Vikings, anything with a sword. I need a shield and a sword. Like, that is my type of shows. Yeah.
Who would you take with you?
Oh, Would anyone go with me?
I'd go with you.
Don't you? Oh, yeah, I'll come with you. Nice. On the island. Okay, yeah. I'll go with you guys. Yeah. I don't know who I would take. So, yeah. Yeah. What about you, Rachel?
I feel like I've got to say Dan, my husband. I mean, can you imagine? I've got two kids. How am I supposed to pick? Like, yeah. I don't know. I probably would take Dan, though. He's very resourceful. So, yeah. You're saying about your mum. He's very resourceful. You'd probably find things you could eat.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we'd have a good time.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd regret it after a while, but yeah, he'd probably be my choice.
You could always send him out to search something.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
You know.
We could have a break. It's fine.
Exactly.
And then Netflix. I don't know if it's on Netflix. I've not actually seen it, but I believe I feel like I really want to see Succession. Has anybody watched
amazing.
It?
Amazing.
Right.
Seen
so
it.
I feel like I would watch
it's
that
amazing.
Because I've not seen it. So that would be my binge while I'm on the island.
See, I'm better with things I've already seen.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like the comfort.
So do I.
I'm a rewatcher. Yeah.
Okay.
I've actually heard that's like a way of like soothing myself though sometimes.
Really
I was like,
is.
I do that.
I do it all the time.
But I feel like I need something new. So Succession. And then lastly, one luxury. You can take one luxury with you.
My weighted blanket.
I've heard of that.
Oh, they're amazing.
I got it for Christmas. Honestly, it's changed my life. Okay.
It's just literally a heavy
it's
blanket.
It's a heavy, it weighs more than I do.
Yeah.
So it's...
So you can't move, okay. But that's kind of the point.
Again, another insight. I nap a lot because I have really poor sleep.
Yeah.
And it's just a really heavy blanket, but it basically kind of compresses your body as you sleep. And it's like being hugged by a giant teddy bear or something.
Wow.
And it is wonderful and I can't live without it. And I never want to get out from underneath it in the mornings. It's very dangerous and I love it.
Wow.
That would be my luxury.
I don't think I would take the weighted blanket.
It's fine anyway, so you can't have it.
Yeah, true. I would take my wig, let's be honest, guys. I'll take as many wigs as I can carry and me and the animals will just have a good time.
Oh my gosh, I can't.
Because I just need, like, my girls with me. Yeah. I need the wigs, guys.
I have
a
great mental image.
Yeah.
Like, with these wild animals.
Like, put it on the possum.
Like, start talking to them after a while.
Yeah,
do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I used to play with dolls a lot as a child. Now I'm older, I see how that's come out in my adult life, that I'm the big doll. But I used to have, like, dolls all across my windowsill, which is a bit creepy. But that is literally how I grew up.
Those porcelain.
Yeah, porcelain. Oh. Yeah, 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 as well. Like these Russian ones, like Frozen.
Oh, they're terrifying.
I loved those dolls. Yeah, they were my girls. So now I've got wigs instead. But yeah. So.
My luxury item. I feel like mine are always food related. I can't think of it. They are. It would be. Not caviar. No. Just some really good salt. I mean, there's probably a way of getting it from the ocean, I suppose, if
I
you boil
say,
water.
Surely.
Yeah, maybe that's
salt.
A poor choice. But you've got to season your food properly, ladies, as far
it's
as
true.
I'm concerned.
It's true.
Yeah.
Gotta
I'm
catch
sticking
the
with salt.
First.
Yeah. But Dan can do that.
Yeah.
That's why he's there.
Dan's there, yeah.
Yeah. Get going back to our hunter gatherer ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, amazing. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing your story
Thank
today.
You,
we're going to be talking all about, I guess, addiction and recovering from addiction. Mm-hmm. And I think especially like the stigma that can be attached to addiction, but also how quite often, especially as driven, ambitious women, we think, oh, this isn't really something that exists within our world. And we're going to be talking about that as well. So it'd be good just first of all to hear, Jo, like, why is it so important to you that we're talking about this today?
Yeah. Well, I think you've kind of covered it really well there. You know, it's really important for me that addiction isn't seen as something that is just kind of a stereotype, one demographic only falls foul to addiction. I think, you know, often when you see addiction in the news, in the media, portrayed in television dramas, all those sorts of things, it is one particular demographic or one particular type of person. But that is really not the case. And unfortunately, it's really difficult because people don't identify addiction in themselves very easily when they're not from those demographics.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, if you're middle class or, you know, upper class, you see substance abuse as a bit of fun or recreational use or, you know, well, I just enjoy a bottle of wine every night because I can afford a luxury bottle of wine every night. And, you know, if you said to someone, are you an addict? They'd be like, well, no, I'm not homeless and I'm not shooting heroin on the side of the road.
Yeah,
and
even,
I'm not
even the type of addiction.
Yeah. Exactly.
So
it's very pigeonholed into one area. And I think even for myself, it took me a long time to identify that I was an addict because I had those own stereotypes in my head of what an addict really looked like. And I think there's also those other stereotypes of thinking that an addict is someone that wakes up in the morning and has to use.
Yeah.
Rather than someone who starts using and cannot stop.
Right.
And I think there's two variations of addicts where there are those people that cannot function on a day-to-day basis without using.
Yeah.
And often it will escalate to that point. But a lot of the time, people who have addiction problems or substance abuse problems will start using a substance and physically cannot put it down.
Okay.
Where other people can pick it up and then dabble in it, you know, have a line here and there or have a couple of drinks and then walk away from it and go home and go to sleep. And for myself, I was not one of those people. I could not stop once I started.
In terms of, you talked about the stereotypes in terms of demographics, I mean, as Christians, people just think this could never happen in a Christian household.
Oh, of course not.
And I remember growing up, my parents said the only thing you will get kicked out of the house for is drugs. Like, if I find drugs, you are out. But my mom was saying, I can't help you. Like, but why do you think, where does that come from, that especially in the Christian community, we can't really deal with that?
Almost thinks like we're invincible in some way.
I think a mixture of that. I think also just the inability to understand and the fear of knowing how to deal with it because it's such a complex issue. And it's so delicate, and it's one of those things that until someone is ready to deal with their own issues, because an addict cannot be helped until they are ready.
Okay.
You know, you cannot force someone to get sober. You cannot force someone to go into rehab until they are willing to go into those places. And, you know, that's where relapses happen. If you force someone to go into recovery, they will relapse again and again and again because they're not mentally prepared or mentally able to acknowledge that they need that support and they need to get well. Mm-hmm. And I think that the church doesn't necessarily always understand that and that they need to be around you, with you, and in it with you to some degree. You know, often I think church is very good at going, we can fix you, we can heal you, we can restore you, but not necessarily in the depths of the dirtiness of it all with you. You know, we're very good at fixing things, not necessarily good at being in the muck.
So what's your story? Just tell us, like, if you feel comfortable, just tell us a bit about, like, growing up, your formative years, and then even just your journey, like, into addiction and where that came from.
So I grew up in a Christian family. My mum and dad, Christians, like both sides of their family, Christians as well. I've got an older brother. We were brought up in the church, you know, just very normal nuclear family. You know, my dad was an electrical engineer. My mum owned her own business. She was an interior decorator. Super normal, you know, really normal, functional family. And I was always a super sensitive child, very kind of emotional. And I remember, you know, even at school, I was always the one that if someone fell over, I wanted to be there to support them, to kind of look after them. And that was who I was as a person. And I loved that about myself. And I think, you know, that kind of grew with me, and I wanted to nurture that. And obviously, growing up in the church, that was something that the church nurtured. That was really celebrated. And obviously, growing up in a Christian environment, you are taught that, obviously, you know, sex before marriage is something that isn't necessarily healthy for you because you know, you should save yourself for the right person, or using drugs and alcohol. We should do alcohol in moderation. You know, alcohol's fine, but moderation, and drugs are a no-no because, you know, for example, my parents had never even smoked cigarettes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they never touched cigarettes. So their experience of drugs was non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's normal for a lot of people. Yeah. Mm. You know, most middle class families probably wouldn't have experienced that,
especially
particularly in Christian
generation. Even just culturally, it was a bit like, nobody really does that. It's only like as we've grown up,
exactly.
That's more normalized, I think.
Exactly. I was bullied at primary school, but you know, that was difficult, particularly being an emotional person. I took it really hard, and I remember my mum saying when I was a bit older that I used to always find a reason to forgive the bully. Be like, she must have a really hard life. And my mum was like, she's just not being very nice to you. Yeah. She's just not a very nice person. Yeah. Secondary school, you know, I think nowadays I probably would have been diagnosed with depression at a young age. Wow. I quickly found towards the latter half of secondary school that I really desired popularity because I saw, when I realised that boys were a thing, you know, when I suddenly got that part of...
fell into place.
..of puberty kind of hit home, I suddenly started to see that the popular girls were the ones that were getting everything from the boys. Mm-hmm, and I wasn't getting any of that because that just... I wasn't part of that group and I wasn't, you know, doing my hair like they were or doing my makeup. So I kind of wedged myself into that group. And it was difficult because it was always slightly toxic friendships because, you know, it's that love-hate.
Yeah.
You kind of get bullied, you kind of don't. Yeah. It's, you know, a bit of push and pull with them. Yeah. But obviously you start drinking and, you know, and I went to a Christian school, but it's... looking back, Christian schools are wild because, again... the, you know, you're taught don't do drugs, don't have sex before marriage, the amount of stuff that was going on.
Yeah,
it's I feel like just when you tell facade, people don't do it, like don't, and you don't say why.
And my personality, if someone says don't do something, I'm like, this must be great.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm going to go and find out why.
Yeah.
So I started drinking, you know, just having a little bit of vodka here and there and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, maybe smoking a bit of weed here and there and just all those sorts of things that kids do. And as I kind of left secondary school, I'd met a boy and we got into a relationship. And I won't go into too much detail, but basically I ended up in quite a difficult relationship and I would say emotionally and psychologically quite abusive. And that kind of projected me into a cycle of really toxic relationships with men, both kind of emotionally, psychologically, physically, all sorts of things. Mm. And it resulted in kind of a series of sexual assaults and kind of a whole variation of just very horrible things. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately what that does, amongst all the other stuff that had happened in my formative years of just having kind of very difficult kind of understanding of who I was as a person, trying to really find myself, was that I had absolutely no self-esteem. Right. It had been completely stripped from me.
Yeah.
And I'd lost any ability to understand who I was as a person and understand how I could socialize with people as a normal person. And what I found was that alcohol made me able to communicate.
Right.
And, you know, I found it really easy to then go out with friends and feel attractive. You know, I felt absolutely hollow, empty, soulless, just disgusting. You know, why would anyone treat me like this? Why would a stranger treat me like this? Why would some man that I'd gone on one date abuse me like this? You know, why would anyone want to do something like that to someone that they said they loved or that they said that they fancied or were attracted to or any of these things. So ultimately, alcohol just changed the internal monologue that I was having. And what I found was that that only lasted for a little while.
Okay.
And the other element of it as well was that I was going out with friends who were the traditional, and I'll say this in inverted commas because, you know, this is late teens, early 20s, traditional fit girls.
Right.
Okay. You know, yeah. And I was, again, you know, I've always been quite alternative, tattoos, piercings, you know, yeah, bit grungy. So I wasn't the girl that I would walk into a bar or a club and the boys would immediately turn and look at and want to hook up with. Mm. I had to work hard at it. Yeah. My personality was what got there. Yeah. But at this stage, I've kind of lost all of that. Right. So I was like, what have I got to offer now? Mm. And I needed to find something. So I became a bit of a lad.
Right.
So what I ended up doing was I was like, I can actually hold quite a lot of drink. Mm. So I became one of the lads. I used to down pints like nobody's business. Wow. I realised that I could drink more and faster than most of the blokes in the pubs. And they found it hilarious.
Yeah.
But it gave me this reputation. Mm. They're like, oh, Jo's out on the lash. Mm. She's up for a good night.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then it became that kind of mentality that actually I had a bit of a personality again.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
because I was then also hanging out with different groups of people, drugs came into the kind of the environment.
Yeah, because you mentioned like the desire for popularity, like almost to be seen.
Yeah, 100%.
I think a lot of people desire that, just to be seen, like acknowledged. And was that a key moment where you thought I'm being seen now? Mm. Like, do you remember a certain moment where you like something shifted, and this is who you were gonna be going forward?
I don't necessarily think there was any particular like light bulb moment that made me go, I'm being seen, you know, this is who I'm going to be. I think it was all very gradual and kind of...
You maybe like arrived there and you were like, oh, okay, this is
yeah, hard. Like I can kind of keep adapting as I go. I think it was all very kind of sneaky.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to say about any kind of substance abuse or addiction is that it is incredibly sneaky. Mm. It doesn't just turn up on your doorstep and then is suddenly there. It really creeps up on you.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was something that I hadn't really kind of thought about the volume of alcohol I was drinking. Mm. And for years, and it wasn't even really until I'd kind of... This is much further down the line. You know, for years and years, even when I was heavily into substance abuse, and this is with drugs, I always used to say, I'm not an alcoholic. Alcohol's not my problem. Drugs are my problem.
Right.
I couldn't fathom that alcohol was an issue. But looking back, alcohol's always been an issue for me. But I'd flipped it on its head.
Mm. Was that like the alcohol is like an introduction to, because I always like want to ask people this question, like people use the term gateway drug, right? I always say, like, especially in school,
weed,
these are the gateway, weed is the gateway.
Smoking a cigarette, gateway drug.
And I always want to know, I don't think people say, oh, I'm going to smoke weed in order to do more. Mm. They don't, nobody wakes up and does that. So I just never
I'd love to end up doing crack one day.
I want to get to there. But would you say, in terms of, is there a gateway, I would say mindset, or is there a gateway, like, do you know what I mean, way of thinking that can help, like, you know, take you into that place where I'm drinking and I don't know, I don't need to stop, you know, is there certain signs?
I think, you know, any vulnerability within ourselves is a gateway.
Yeah,
that's so true.
Yeah,
you know, the vulnerability that I had was the need for love. And it wasn't that I had no love, you know. My parents have always been super supportive, always loved me. My friends have always loved me and given me that support. But it was a romantic love that I desired because it had been stripped from me. And I think that's the thing that was really important to claim back. And I became quite promiscuous because I was determined to reclaim my sexuality.
Ownership of that,
because, and that's really common for anyone who's gone through any sexual trauma, because, you know, you've lost your identity because someone has taken it from you.
Stolen it from you.
Yeah. So therefore, what do? You take it back. But I was so vulnerable because obviously I'm putting myself in situations that I didn't want to be in, really, when I think about it. So then I'm drinking to make myself feel confident or sexy or any kind of emotion, just feel anything.
Yeah.
But actually what you do is you make yourself feel numb. Mm. So then I'm trying to feel something else. So then the drugs sneak in.
Yeah.
So ultimately you're kind of just topping up all the time.
Yeah.
And I discovered cocaine, you know, cocaine. Yeah. Wow, yeah. What a feeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember the first time I ever had a line of coke and I was like, oh my goodness, this is incredible.
It's like in the film, because I just think, like, why do they like, their eyes open, like, like, what is the...
Well, I can assure you.
What was the journey from? So you were going out drinking regularly, and but you were like, I'm not really seeing. It wasn't an alcohol in your mind. Right. It wasn't an alcohol addiction. And I even wonder, Sinead, if you were asking about, like, did you know or how do you recognize? But I wonder if maybe sometimes the reason we don't recognize the addictions, especially substance addictions, is because of what you said at the beginning, is you weren't getting up every morning like, I need a drink. This is just my recreation. I'm just hanging out with my friends and having a great time. Mm-hmm. But what was kind of the transition between that and starting to use the drugs? Like, was it just that you were in the crowd and somebody's like, do you want to try this? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Twofold. I think just going back slightly, you know, I think with the alcohol as well, I think part of the reason we don't necessarily identify it in the UK is that a lot of our culture in the UK is alcohol related. Alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's what done around alcohol.
What do we do in the UK, particularly in London or any big city? Yeah. We go to the pub.
Yeah.
What do? We go for a drink with our mates.
Yeah.
Everything is booze related. You look on the news, everyone's getting, you know, drunk because that's what we do. Yeah. We are known as a society for getting leery.
Yeah.
You know, football hooligans get drunk. You know, we are known as a culture to be people who drink a lot. Mm. So actually, if you think about it, why would I identify as an alcoholic? Because everyone around me is doing it.
It's the norm.
I think the thing that, looking back, what I should have realised is that when all my mates went home and went to bed, I would go home and buy a bottle of vodka and keep drinking. Wow. And that was the thing. Just because I didn't wake up in the morning and start drinking, my brain was going, well, you can't be an alcoholic. Mm. I was still drunk.
Right.
I didn't need to keep drinking. I'd then just go to the pub after work again. But the kind of transition into the drugs was, I was hanging out with people who were using.
Right.
And I was complaining that, you know, I didn't necessarily enjoy feeling out of control. And that was another thing that I was noticing, that I wanted to control what I was feeling. And again, you know, with everything that had happened, I didn't like having the lack of ownership of myself and, lack of ownership of my faculties and of my body, and not really understanding how to control my limbs all the time.
Yeah.
And someone suggested, well, have a line of this, you know, have a go. And I knew that they used a bit and, you know, I wasn't really that bothered, and I'd never really noticed much of a change in them. Just noticed that they could drink a bit more.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, why not? And I remember having a line and didn't really do a huge amount other than just made me feel great. And then I did another one and then another one and then another one, and then I was like, I can't stop. I want more. So I bought more. And then I was like, you let me know where you get this. Like, next time we go out, let's buy some. And it became a pattern. You know, I'd want to go out every night after work, or, you know, every Thursday, Friday night. And then on a Monday, because that was student night. So if we went out on a Monday, we could get cheap drinks.
Yeah.
So I could spend more on drugs. And, you know, it became more of a pattern. And then particularly once I was, you know, well established in London as well. It's everywhere.
But even the fact that, so I have so many questions. I think it's, first of all, just, was there any voice like telling you, like, don't go down, like?
Okay.
I was just like, is there, because what is, there's the pull, like, some of us hear our mum's voice in our heads, or, you know, so, like, I want to know, like, what, whether there was something pulling at you, but then also, it sounds like you were functioning, so.
So how old were you at this, like, at this point?
I'd started kind of recreationally using cocaine just before I'd moved from Cambridge to London. So I would have been 18, 19.
So you were at uni or you were starting your
career? I didn't go to university.
But you moved to London for work then?
Yeah.
So you were working. It's like Sinead said, you were functioning.
I've never not worked.
Right.
Okay. It's just a complete different the stereotype, because it's like Chris Rock with a bag of cocaine outside someone's car. And it's like, no, this is a working person. Sorry, but that's what I see, you know. So you're going to work, you're showing up.
Yep.
Can anybody else in your life tell that you are building towards an addiction? Like your family or, you know?
I think there's a couple of people that probably had noticed some behaviour changes, particularly, you know, I've become a little bit more erratic, possibly in my behaviours, and a little bit more unpredictable. In terms of my work, the bonus of what I do is that I'm a freelancer. So I'm I'm transitioning from one place to another all the time. So actually, if I ever got to a position where I thought someone might be onto me, I'd just move on to a new contract. But I worked at one place in particular where I was actually ended up freelancing there for quite a significant period of time. But quite a lot of the people in that particular company were also using.
Right.
I see.
That was what I was going to ask as well.
That's the industry I work in.
And if you're in an environment where that's the norm also, don't see it as you're not going to view it as an addiction.
Also, they're facilitating and enabling.
Yes.
And I was also enabling them. Mm. So we're also fueling each other and knowing that we deep down probably going, oh, we're probably both addicts, or there's a number of us who have an issue here, but we're kind of enabling everyone, you know. And it got to a stage at this point where I was buying a friend of mine and I were buying blocks of speed, because speed is really cheap, much cheaper than cocaine, and has a very similar effect. It's basically methamphetamine. So we're buying blocks of speed in 7 ounce chunks and divvying it up between kind of a group of us. And I was wrapping it up in tinfoil and putting it in my bra. Wow. And I would take it to work with me. And throughout the day, I'd just go to the loo, put a bit on my gums, crack on. Now, the feedback that I got from this agency was incredible.
Whoa. Right. At this time that you were working for.
That I was off my face all the time. They were like, she is really fast. She's really good at what she does. She absolutely smashes through projects. She's just on it all the time. And the irony of that is completely not lost on me.
Yeah.
The fact that they are praising me for, you know, the speed and agility and ability to, you know, go through work at double time than anyone else. It's because I'm on drugs and I'm using on a daily basis. And it was at this stage that I started to think, this isn't normal, is it? Right, you know, other people aren't using speed during the day.
Right. Yeah. So, like you said, there was a voice. Was there... like, what? How do you get out of that routine? How? What pulls you back?
Yeah, was there a moment where you were like, "I need to speak to someone," or
it? Kind of. I think it took me years to get to that stage.
So that was your habit. You're still drinking, doing a bit of speed and things through the day for years. Yeah. And you were functioning though.
Yeah, and then in the evenings I was using cocaine. So cocaine was my special treat. That was evenings. Mm-hmm. Speed during the days, and then because it's gross, it tastes disgusting. I mean, it's gross anyway, but and I was drinking during the day as well. I would find an excuse to have a drink at lunch because I'd got to that stage as well where I couldn't function without alcohol during the day. But I'd always, again, this is the lie of addiction. I'd be like, if I make it to midday, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm not an addict.
Right.
If I make it to lunchtime, I don't have a problem because it's after 12.
Okay.
So the absolute insanity of addiction is that I don't have a problem if I don't drink before lunch.
Yeah.
And it blows my mind that I was telling myself this, convincing myself that I did not have an issue. But then at lunchtime, I was downing 3 pints because I was absolutely gasping for alcohol. On a Monday, when all my friends were having a coffee. And I'm like gagging because I cannot get through the rest of the day. And then it would hit 4 o'clock and I'd be like, I'm going to go and work in the pub.
Right.
I need to focus. Was I focusing? Of course not. I was sitting with my laptop, maybe doing a bit of emails, but snorting,
right.
you know, in the toilets and getting absolutely wasted. And then going home and starting that cycle all over again. And, you know, at this stage, I was very aware that something wasn't right. But I was also aware of other people had exactly the same lifestyle as me. I was surrounding myself with people who were doing the same thing. And I think because I, and you do this as an addict, you surround yourself with like-minded people. And then it stops you from having to face the facts of what you're doing. And addiction is a disease of secrecy and of lies. And you not only are lying to yourself, but you lie to everybody around you. So, you know, I was living a normal functioning life, you know, on the surface of it, apart from having a drink in the pub at lunch, but I'd buy everyone around. So I was, I was a very popular person. You know, I lived a great life because I was working. I always had contracts. You know, I was never poor. But underneath the surface, my life was an absolute disaster. It was a mess. I couldn't function and I had no ability to maintain healthy relationships with people. You know, I was very volatile. And I think in answer, kind of a long-winded answer to your question, where things kind of escalated to was that I knew that I was really starting to have a problem when I started to become quite violent and volatile and my reactions to drugs were becoming really unusual and not having the same impact that they had before. My mental health was just all over the place. You know, it was completely just manic one day and then I would be suicidal the next. And, you know, my reactions to people were just bizarre. You know, one thing that I find funny now, but at the time, really not funny, I'd bought off a drug dealer. Now, bearing in mind, this guy is maybe 6'5", big bloke. I was obviously a mess at the time that I'd bought from him, put a packet in my pocket, obviously gone to the toilet, pulled it out, dropped it, not noticed. Had then kind of tried to find it, couldn't find it. Launched myself down the stairs in this pub and completely tried to knock him out. Like, oh, I am maybe 5'3", 5'4". So bearing in mind, you know, the insanity of my addiction was that I had convinced myself that he'd shortchanged me. Whereas I'd just lost my drugs. And I tried to attack a drug dealer. And my friend had to carry me out because this guy was going to stab me.
Oh, my gosh.
You know,
absolute
madness. And there's just all sorts of things. And then there was another, you know, kind of running up to when I really realised that I had a big issue. I remember using on my own in my flat. And I spent the entire night staring out the peephole. I lived in a block of flats where there was no way you could get in without a fob, and there was only one other flat opposite me. So it wasn't like I lived in a long corridor where people were coming and going all the time. It was a really echoey area. But I was convinced that someone was there watching me. So I spent probably 4 hours with my eye glued to the peephole, then running to a window, looking out the window. I lived on the third floor, top floor, then running back, then running back. Then running back, doing a line every now and then in between. Just the paranoia was insane. And the sleep paralysis. I was having sleep paralysis and seeing things and just these hallucinations were just out of control. And I think, you know, this kind of, I'd noticed very quickly that I was spiraling and things were just becoming insane. And I was becoming insane.
And you hadn't changed what you were using then, or
I was still buying off the same people, but I was using a lot more. You know, and that's the problem with addiction, is that you just keep adding and adding and adding and adding. And, you know, I could drink 10, 11 pints easily. I'm little, you know. I don't have a lot of meat on my bones.
So is it also because your body relies on this thing? Yes. Like, I always like to say that it's not, people might say drugs, but sometimes there's things that we can't live without, and no one should live that way. But especially when your body
is function without
pushing you. You couldn't, you can't wake up, you can't. I've heard that people can never break it. Like some people, they say that they're, but then I've seen an interview where the guy said, I'm addicted to Diet Coke now because that's my placebo to what, but he's always going to be addicted to something.
Is that true?
How true is that? And how does somebody say it's enough? Like you said, someone has to be ready. Did God make you ready? Like,
how was the point where enough was enough for you?
I think kind of amongst all of this chaos, I would say that I'd always would have called myself a Christian, but had been incredibly angry at God, had walked away from the church. I'd been really hurt by the church as well. I'd joined a church, and whilst I'd been at this church trying to get help, the way that they had treated my story was like it was a very salacious, dramatic thing, rather than a sensitive, delicate,
and part of you.
Yeah, and also bearing in mind at the stage that I was sharing it was in the midst of everything. You know, I was at the heart of everything, and I needed to be kind of cuddled, wrapped with kind of fluffy blankets, rather than being in a position where, like now, you know, I'm years free from my addiction and from the trauma. And able to share. And I think I was so hurt by what had happened that I was furious at God. Because I was still aligning God and church as the same thing. Which a lot of people do. Which is fair, but it's hard to break. But I'd gone through this phase of being like, God, you just got to take it away. No ownership on myself. Really lazy praying of like, mate, I'm not doing anything. You've just got to get rid of it. Like once this pack of Coke's gone, you just got to take my addiction.
Make it so that you can't get anything.
No, it wasn't even that. I was like, I'm not deleting any numbers, but you've just got to, I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and I'm going to have no desire to use ever again. That was literally the prayers I prayed. Obviously, that didn't work. What God did was, I think, kind of increased the intensity of everything that was happening, because those cycles were within kind of a really short space of time. And the last time I used, I tried to go cold turkey for a week, and that was a disaster, obviously. And I'd ended up going out on my own. And the last thing I remember was, I'd started drinking at 7 in the evening, and then I don't remember anything until 4 in the morning. So I have no idea what I did in that time. But I remember being in a warehouse in Hackney somewhere and using. And I bought something from someone that I thought was Coke, and it wasn't. And I don't know what it was, but I had a really bad reaction. And I don't remember anything from then until about 6 in the morning. And I was at home, and I don't know how I got home. I should be dead. 100% should be dead. But I know that God saved me. I honestly it blows my mind. But that was the moment that I just suddenly went, the only way I'm ever going to get out of this is if I ask someone to help me. And the only person I could think of was my mum. And I phoned her at 6 in the morning. And at this stage, they actually lived in Suffolk. And I phoned my mum and I was like, Mum, I think I might need some help. And she was like, oh, finally.
So your mum had been aware of how serious this had become as well.
I don't think they'd really kind of clocked that. The drug use, but the alcohol for sure. And so then she came and got me, literally made me pack up suitcase because I was living on my own and I was like, there's no way you're staying here. And then I ended up moving in with some friends of mine who I was meant to stay with them for 2 weeks and I ended up living with them for 2 years and withdrew and got, and I've been clean ever since. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So many questions.
It's quite an intense story. Yeah. There's a lot to it. So.
Yes, yeah. I think it's just thinking about the decision making.
Yeah. Mm. Well, there wasn't really much.
Let's be honest.
But it takes courage. Like obviously you said that it was getting intensified, but to say I decide now something has to change. Mm. You know, is that what all of us need to do? It has to be a decision.
Yeah.
Mm. And how much, because also we can say things like, you know, it's a new year, new me.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
What is it is it a heartfelt decision? Mm-hmm. Is it? Yeah. Yeah.
Was it the brush with like death, maybe?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think that was definitely it. It was, I will die. Mm. This is it. Mm. Like, I am going to die if I don't change what is happening. Mm. And I can't do this on my own because I tried to do 1 week without anything and I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
It had been the hardest week of my life. I'd skipped work. You know, it had been horrific.
Yeah.
And obviously it'd been horrific. I tried to withdraw completely cold turkey. Yeah. Like, that is really dangerous. Mm. And I would put out there that if anyone is heavily using, do not do it on your own and do not withdraw without medical help.
Yeah.
Like, please speak to someone because it can be really, really, really bad for you and really, really dangerous. But I think that kind of instant just made me realise that I was going to die.
Mm.
I was killing myself, willingly killing myself.
Mm.
And I was asking God to fix it, but he wasn't going to just take it away.
Yeah.
I had to actually hand it over.
Mm-hmm.
And part of handing it over was opening up to the people that I loved and go, I really need your help.
Yeah.
I cannot do this by myself. And I think there's something there for the kind of the Christian community is that we can't do it on our own. We have to open it up and say, actually, I really need help.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't something I can handle by myself. And it was the hardest phone call I've ever made in my life.
Yeah, I bet it was.
It was horrific. And I know for my family and particularly for my mum that it broke her heart.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm.
But I also know that it changed her life for the better as well.
Yeah. And there, so obviously you had that period of withdrawal. What was that like just practically? Like, because were you working? Did you carry on working? No. Did you take time out?
Yeah. Yeah. There was no way I could have worked.
No.
I wasn't very well, let's just put it that way. Yeah. It's not a pretty thing.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, I didn't need to use medication to withdraw. Okay. I was at a stage where the doctors were, it was okay. Mm. They did give me some medication just in case, but you're still not.
Yeah,
I won't go into detail, but it's not a pretty thing. Mm.
I think the word shame just comes to mind, and having to, people can't even admit, you know, what weight they are.
Yeah,
that coming to your family, then a doctor, then to keep admitting, you know, how did you deal with, like, what could be shame or embarrassment? Yeah.
Mm.
And because I think that's for a lot of people, that stigma, they'd rather live in
that
the dark.
That can be the very thing that stops you from going to someone, can't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think all of that was before the admission to my mum.
Okay.
I think that's what had been stopping me for a long time. And I think by the time I'd got to that point, it's almost what I would imagine like, I've never had children, but what I'd imagine it'd be like once you're giving birth, you'd kind of like,
it's happening.
It's happening. Yeah. Like, I've got no shame now.
Yeah.
But the kind of thought of it is worse than actually what it's like when you get there. Yeah. And for me, the thought of sharing and the thought of asking for help was so much more terrifying and shameful than actually what it was. And again, I think addiction is, it's just lies all the time. It's telling you all these lies about who you are, but also how other people will receive you. And it's constantly going in your head. And, you know, for the spiritual in us, you know, it's the enemy telling you all these horrible lies. And I believe really passionately that Satan is heavily in addiction.
Right.
And I think that actually the freedom of just going, do you know what? Whatever, mate. And going, I need help, completely broke through that barrier for me to then it's go, amazing. Actually, there is shame in this to some degree, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay to feel a bit ashamed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's a natural feeling.
Yeah.
But there is complete hope on the other side.
Yeah. And you, obviously you'd had a really fractured relationship with the church, but more so with God.
Yeah.
What was the healing like in that? So as you're coming out of withdrawn, I know this is like over a long period of time, I'm sure. What were some of the elements of that part of the story?
Beautiful. So the friends that I was living with, so I'd met them through this previous church. And they'd been, you know, brilliant, and I'd known them for a long time. So my friend's husband, he had actually become the vicar of the church that I'm now part of. And so I'd had some really clear boundaries put in place that this is part of my recovery, that living with them, I had a curfew, you know, I had to cut certain people out of my life. You know, this is all part of recovery. It's a big thing. It's so not hard. Just like, waking up the next day and not drinking. You know, I had to delete things off my phone. I had to cut people out of my life. I couldn't go certain places. I wasn't allowed in certain areas. You know, if I was going to go out in the evening, I had to be with certain people. I couldn't stay out past a certain time at night.
It's like you're a child again, almost. Like,
you do. You completely strip everything away. And because you have to rebuild trust.
Right, yeah.
You know, the trust has to be built, because I couldn't be trusted on my own to not use. But part of that also was that their deal was, you're living under our roof, come to our church.
Yeah, it's like you say, it's literally going back to like that child.
Yeah, I was like,
stay, like, you're doing everything we say.
Yeah, and I was like, But my mum was like, do you want to come to our church? Because my dad's a vicar as well. Yeah. And she was like, go to their church or ours. I was like, I'll go to theirs. And it was such a unusual experience for me in many ways, because obviously having been in what had been a really horrible experience for me, where my story had been treated as kind of bait, really, to bring other people in and be like, oh, meet Jo, this is her story. And other people had shared it on my behalf. And I was like, whoa, like, not cool. Or at one point someone had said, oh, don't date Jo because she's slept with so many people. And I was like, wow, okay, like, thanks. Like, this is cool. But then walking into this church where I remember saying to my friend, oh, I've shared a bit of my story with this couple and I'm really nervous that now they're going to tell everyone. And she was like, okay, just wait. And then a couple of weeks later, no one had come up to me and said anything. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
No one gossips here. What is happening?
What is this?
And my friend was like, this is called safe church. Yeah. This is called loving church.
Yeah.
And suddenly I started to realize that I was in an environment where people weren't interested in the kind of salaciousness the drama of it. They were interested in me as a person.
Yeah.
They were interested in being with me through the rough horribleness of it, but also they were interested in my talents. Yes. And amazing. Within a few months, they were like, hey, do you want to lead worship? And I was like, well, I mean, sure, but surely I'm not ready. They're like, yeah, of course you are. You know, this is the perfect time. You're vulnerable. Yeah. Like, this is where, you know, this is where God will kind of flow through you. And and they were just like giving me the support that I needed. And yeah, it's been such a breath of fresh air. And I think actually what that really did is restored my hope and my faith in God in a new way, because I'd been so angry. It taught me that I can be angry at God, and that's fine. Like, let's be honest, we've all been there. Yeah. And there's times that I often still am, you know. I'll be like, why am I still single? But then God's like, mate, let's chill. Like, you've got a lot of, like, healing still to do. And then other times I'm like, actually, you've got it. Okay. I know we're on the right path. So, and it's taught me that I don't have to look like everyone else to have a relationship with God. Yeah. Like, I can do it in my own way. I can chat to him in my own way. And, you know, they've just been amazing. And I couldn't see myself being in anywhere else, to be honest. So.
Before we do an audience dilemma, you can read one, Sinead, because I know I've got some good ones that have come in. The last little thing I wanted to ask is so practical. Now, obviously, you would you say that you're recovered? Like, how? What's the word? What? How would you even describe yourself now? Because I guess the question into that is, what do you do now to keep yourself like healthy and in check? And you know, are there certain things that you think, if I cross that line, I need to pull back? Or like, how do you describe yourself as a recovered addict? That you're clean? Or
I think it changes. The vernacular is always a bit different depending on who I'm speaking to. And I think, you know, I think I'll always use the word addict. I don't want people to ever see it as a dirty word. And I think for a long time, people have seen it as a dirty word. And actually, I'm like, no, I'm an addict. And I have an addictive personality. I know that, you know, that is part of who I am. You know, I might say I'm in recovery or I'm sober or I'm clean or, you know, it will change. So, yeah, I think it just varies depending on where and who I'm with. I don't want people to be uncomfortable. So it's more just kind of gauging the environment. You know, meeting the CEO of a new company I'm working with. FYI, I'm an addict. It doesn't really necessarily go down right in the first meeting.
I love how you seem to know yourself well, though. Like, from where the story started, where you're putting pieces of yourself together, it's like you know yourself so well that you can speak about yourself and be clear. And I think a lot of us can't do that. So we don't know how to ask for help because we don't know what we don't even know ourselves. So I think that is beautiful to see that transition, you know. It's just
My mum, one of my favorite things, my mum had a picture of me years and years and years ago of like a Venetian vase, and she said that it had been whole and that one day it shattered. And for years, I'd been trying to sellotape it back together. And it was, like, just a mess. Like, obviously, trying to sellotape one of those vases back together has just been a mess. And then she says, over the last few years, it's been restored again. And she keeps getting updates on these pictures. But it's now fully restored. But, you know, I can't remember what the name of it is, but in that Japanese way where they do it with the gold. So they fill in the cracks with the gold. And I think that's such a beautiful picture of how God does restore us. It's like, I have cracks. I have been broken, but I have been filled in with gold. Like, he's filling in all those little gaps of kind of brokenness.
That's awesome. Just like practically, what's like one thing you do now to keep yourself in check or just keep yourself healthy, really?
Accountability. It's sharing with people and who I'm closest with. And I have kind of a handful of people that I'm just brutally honest with about where I'm at and how I'm feeling.
That's huge. So just thinking about these questions, like, so it's actually more normal probably than we think that we might have friends or family that are struggling with addiction, but you were saying before, like, they've got to be ready.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
such a key thing. And yeah. people are so guilty of pushing people mm. towards programs or
yeah.
some kind of healing when they're not ready. And that can just result in relapse, I yeah. guess. Mm. But is there anything that you think, like, if there is somebody listening and they've got friends or family who are struggling with addiction, that they could say, or any way they could make themselves available in the meantime that would be helpful?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one because I think, you know, the more you push someone that's not ready, the more likely they are to isolate themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's really dangerous. But also, as you say, at the same time, you're desperate to help someone yeah. and particularly someone that you love. It's an impossible situation to be in. I think if, you know, the best things to say to someone who is in active addiction but isn't quite ready to get help mm-hmm. is just make your presence known and okay. make it really clear that you're there. Mm-hmm. You know, say that when you are ready
yeah.
to talk and, you know, if you feel ready to talk to me, I'm always here. I'm mm-hmm. at the end of a phone, yeah. whatever time of night, mm-hmm. what, you know, and mm-hmm. that's the thing. I knew my mum would answer her mm-hmm. phone.
Yeah.
You know, I knew my mum mm-hmm. was that person that I could call at any time mm-hmm. of night. And I'd called her before when I was yeah. using, you know, mm-hmm. I knew she would answer. So I think it's just knowing that person would be available mm-hmm. and making yourself available, but also, just that you'll be there without any judgment,
yeah.
that you're there to just offer a listening ear mm. and some kind of practical support when needed, like a cup of tea or mm. a hug or a shoulder mm. to cry on, but that you're not necessarily going to go, right, now we're going to yes. take you to this rehab yeah. clinic and do this, mm. because that is really quite a scary concept. Mm. It needs yeah. to be kind of done in little steps.
Yeah. yeah, so helpful.
I just have to say, like, you talking about what a Christian should look like, and I just mm. have to say that you are a reflection of what a Christian should look like. No, mm. you really are, because it's the evidence of God's goodness
yeah.
mm. and his faithfulness. And mm. I just looking at you, it just hit me that you are that, oh, you know. So you. This has been amazing, but mm. I just really wanted to say that you thank just, you. Yeah, you really reflect that. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Mm. We yeah. have yeah. more to ask you. So it's just some audience dilemmas. Okay. Yeah. From the outside, you would never be able to tell that I struggle with an addiction. I look like a high-flying career woman who, mm. for the most part, has her life together mm. because I'm still not able to get... because I'm still able to get my work done and not fall apart. I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm a high-functioning addict. Yeah. Mm. My job comes with a lot of stress, but the payout feels worth it. From the moment I was in university, I knew that I would do whatever it took to make the most of myself. And I knew that if I just applied myself, I'd be able to get the most out of life. I'm now realizing that while I pride myself on my work ethic, my health mm-hmm. and mental clarity is deteriorating. Yeah. As well as this, drugs are something which are everywhere in my industry. So it never crossed my mind that it wasn't normal to rely on them to get through work because everyone else was doing the same thing. Since I don't look like your typical addict, I've been struggling with reaching out and getting help. It would come as a shock to my friends, and there's no way that I can tell my family. I want to confide in someone, but do have a fear of being judged and having my already, oh Lord, existing feelings of shame heightened. Should I seek professional help, or should I find one or two close friends who I could confide in? I used to go to church before my work got more stressful, but I'd feel like a fraud going back, knowing that I'm still living in a way that doesn't exactly align with what Christians should be like.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, firstly, what should a Christian be like, right?
Yeah.
No Christian should be anything. Mm. Let's think about who Jesus used to hang out with.
Yeah.
Like, and that was the lie that I told myself for a long time. A Christian should be this and look like this. Yeah. No, like, that's... Yeah. So I just want to kind of cast dispel that off that, and dispel that, because I think that is the lie of addiction, saying that you can't walk into a church building. But I get it, and it's hard. I mean, it sounds like probably work in a very similar industry to what I do. It's a really tough one.
When it talks about stress, especially,
yeah,
because I mean, yeah. when you're stressed, you do. I buy a lot of things when I'm stressed, knowing that. So even people say giving an excuse like stress is a legitimate reason.
Yeah, definitely.
How can you start to say, yes, you're stressed, but there needs to be another way of dealing with that?
I think it's really difficult with addiction because it's not as simple as just like, I'm just going to stop spending money or I'm going to stop eating sugar. Mm-hmm. You know, addiction is something that is physically incapable. You know, you cannot physically just stop doing it. So my recommendation would be, firstly, to seek some professional help. And there's lots of anonymous places to do that. Yeah. You know, I went in through Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. Wow. And those programs are amazing for those reasons, because the fact that they are anonymous means that you can walk in and walk out and you don't have to share any personal details about who you are. Mm-hmm. And that is the beauty of those programs. Mm. And they are the reason that they are there. Mm. And, you know, there are other programs like them, but they do them online as well. Mm. And I found that that was really useful during lockdown, you know, having a struggle, you know, if I felt really, you know, if I found that I was having a really hard day, that actually join a Zoom meeting and you don't even have to turn your camera on and you can dip in and out of these spaces. So I'd recommend having a look on those websites and checking those out. But I think also, you know, there is also that lie of not being able to tell someone, but I'm sure there is someone in your life that you could reach out to, and if not, I'd be more than happy to talk because I know what it's like. And I think, you know, please don't feel that you've got no one to speak to, because the last thing that I'd want to see is someone just kind of getting further and further into that spiral, because there is always a way out and there is always freedom.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for being so vulnerable as well, just sharing your story. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think dispelling some of the stereotypes as well around addiction. It's really, like, it's really freeing.
Yeah.
But lastly, I wanted to ask, because obviously we're a community at Magnify, is there anything that you're doing or any work that you're doing at the minute that you'd love to support, we can support you in? Like, where can we find you online?
There's nothing in particular, but I think obviously, you know, please look me up on Instagram. Should I say what my handle is?
Yeah,
it's at joegoldie89. And obviously if anyone is having any issues with addiction, please reach out. I'd love to chat. Or if you're worried that someone that you love is struggling, then please do. And do support your friends and family who are struggling, because the difficulty with addiction is that that person needs to be ready. So please don't give up on them. You know, I think that's something that is often the case, is that, you know, I was very, very lucky that my parents and my family and my loved ones have always stuck by me. You know, I know that I'm very privileged in that respect, but a lot of people get walked away from and abandoned in their time of need. And I think ultimately it's something that just stick with it. You know, they will get there.
Amen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of the Magnify Conversations. We hope you've enjoyed it and found it really value adding. If you're new to our community, or perhaps you just joined us for the first time today, we have an Instagram. Our handle is at Magnify Collective. You'll be able to find everything you need there to keep up to date with us. Next up, if you have a story that you would like to share on the Magnify Conversations, you can go on our website, magnifycollective.com, and share your story with us. We really look forward to seeing you for next week's episode on Monday.